Test. The Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety, Room 643, April 12th, 2018.
Davis, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Justin, I'd like to welcome everyone here today, and I am really looking forward to the public comment on prison segment that we're going to have. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Davis. So next on the agenda, Sergeant-at-Arms. I don't see one.
I didn't take it.
Got it. Oh.
No, I'm fine.
Excuse me, Representative Bowles.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon.
So today, Sergeant-at-Arms, Terry Edmondson. Thank you. Becky Myrick, Francis Patterson, they are from the Senate. The House Sergeant at Arms, John Gilbert. David Lynch, the come. Dean Mashburn, and Glenn Wall. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. So do I hear a motion on the minutes? And I think Representative Turner has some clarifications or technical corrections.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. I have three corrections, and I have submitted them to the clerk. So I will move to approve as amended.
Do I hear a second? Any objections to the minutes as amended that you will be provided copies of? Seeing none, we will proceed to the next thing on the agenda. That will be the public comment on prisons. And before I do so, I think we have, where did my little list go back then? Officers that are here. If you'll bear with me just a moment, please. All right. So I think we have some officers here today, correctional officers that received awards this morning, and I'm going to ask someone from the department to stand and recognize those officers, please. Who wants to stand and recognize those officers? And if you will identify yourself, please.
Kenneth Lassiter, Director of Prisons. Thank you, Madam Chair. We had our superintendent / RD meeting today here in Raleigh, and we invited, it's normally held on Wednesday, we had some moving around, so it happened today, and we invited four guests to come up and witness what takes place in the RD's meetings and to assist and to provide input as to the making of policy. And of the four guests, two was really recognized for some outstanding heroism and some outstanding service to the system because of that. One of them is Sergeant Carrier, if you'll please stand. Last month, an inmate at Lumberton Corrections was having an event in the dining hall where he was choking. Sergeant responded, performed the Heimlich maneuver, and actually saved the inmate's life. The inmate did not. He went to medical inside the facility, and he is now doing well at his facility. So we recognized him at his facility a few days ago, and we brought him up just to recognize him in front of the RDs. So Sergeant Carrier. The other young lady, when we had the tragic events up at Passport Tank, we had an officer that had only been with us a year, and she responded when we called, and when she came in, we gave her a very unique task, and she was assigned to the family members of the officers that were hurt as well as those that already fallen, and she went to the hospital up in Virginia, and she stayed with those family members some over 300 some hours throughout this whole endeavor, and she was doing her career, and we felt the need to bring her in, one, and debrief her and really, you know, provide her with anything that she may need, but also just to recognize that we had put her in an undaunted task and we had given her some responsibilities that I, a 29-year employee, never had. And so we wanted to recognize her as well, and as Officer Flowers. The other two young ladies that are present, we're trying to recruit, and so we're looking out and trying to figure out what it takes to get correction officers. So we have a 20-year veteran and a 1-year veteran that we call up, and we recognize them for what they're doing at their facilities. And one has been drafted or volunteered to be in a video. And so we have Officer Knox and Officer Ecom that came up with 20 years from Polk Correction.
So there may be other correctional officers or support staff in the audience. Do we have other correctional officers or support staff? If you will stand, sir.
I am sorry, Madam Chair. We did meet here, and he didn't come with the group, but Officer Adams from Foothills, and thank you. And he came up to support Mr. Mitchell, I think is what he told me, who's the RD from the facility. Also, we have the regional directors from all of the regions that we have facilities are present with us today, also to hear what's going on and partake of some of their information.
Thank you. And if all of you would please stand, let us recognize you. We have the public comment on prison section, and we have 11 who have signed up to speak, and I know the agenda said that you would have 2 minutes. Well, I've tried to say something in 2 minutes before, and I did not get it out. So since we have a limited number of people signed up to speak, we're going to let you speak a little bit longer. So the first one on the list is Samuel Adams. So Samuel, I think as long as you don't go over 5 minutes, I think we'll be good.
I can probably do that, madam. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As said, my name is Sam Adams. I work for Foothills Correctional Institution, which is a close custody facility in Morganton, North Carolina. I've been with the system about 5.5 years. Prior to that, I was a police officer for 21 and a half. I believe I bring some unique observations and perspectives into the prison system from the street. I'd like to share a couple of those with you. The first, I've had several people ask me what the difference is between working the street and working in the prison. My resounding answer every time is exactly the same. My very worst working day on the street, 20% of the population that I dealt with, what we called citizen contacts, were bad people. Again, truly bad people. Meaning 80% of the people I dealt with on a day-in, day-out basis were good, solid North Carolina citizens, most of them. Yeah, they may have been speeding a little. They may not have their seatbelt on. Doesn't make them a criminal. Again, so 20% of the people I came in contact with were truly bad people. Every day, those of us here, we walk into a facility, 100% of our people, our citizen contacts, are bad people. They have the commitment papers into the prison system to show it, yet we're not treating them that way. We're not treating them as bad people that they are. I think that needs to change. Secondly, as police officers, we arrested criminals. That's what we did. We took them to jail. We took them to the magistrate's office. They were tried. They were convicted. Then they were sentenced as criminals. The moment they walk through our doors, they become victims. They become victims of their circumstance. They become victims of their neighborhoods. That's not what they are. They've made choices. They've made decisions to do the things that they've done. We're not addressing those issues. We're treating them as if it's a social problem. We're treating it as if it's a mental problem, a mental issue. Folks, these are bad people that we deal with. You know, we've had 5 deaths last year. That should be enough to tell us that these are not good people. These are bad people. Some of the things that I believe that we could change, some of our training. I know we have several police officers in the audience. Most of them, I'm most sure, attended BLET in the community college system. The reason that that system works very well, and it works as well as it does, the officer that is on the or in the classroom today instructing was on the street yesterday working. They know what's going on. They know what's happening. They're relevant. They're current. Nothing against our OSDT staff. Nothing against them. However, they're not in the facilities on a daily basis. They're not working the floor. They're sitting in a classroom. They're dealing with students day in, day out, rather than learning what's relevant, knowing what's relevant today. They've not maybe been in a facility for 20 years, 10, 15, who knows? They do not know what's happening today. They don't know what's going on in those facilities today. I know that my presentation is a little short, but again, I would like for you to take the opportunity to think about those of us that walk into those buildings every day. 100% of our citizen contacts are bad people. Thank you.
Thank you. So next is Susan Beasley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Suzanne Beasley with the State Employees Association. I will be brief. Wendy Callahan, Sergeant Megan Callahan's mother, wrote a statement and sent it to me last night and specifically asked me to read it to you today. I'm not going to do that. It is impossible for me to convey her heart, and you need to hear from her. So, Senator Randleman, thank you so much, Representative Davis, Representative Bowles, for making time for this public comment today. But it's our sincere hope that in the future you can make some time for Ms. Callahan to be heard. We think it's important that you hear from her. Thank you.
So, Susan, may I ask a question, please?
Yes, ma'am.
So, is she here today?
She is not. I'm sorry. They have suffered another death in their family. And the one-year anniversary of Megan's death is upon us, and they're just struggling, so she could not be here.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Madam Chair.
Yes, yes, sir.
If she has a copy, will she allow that be submitted for the records?
I am certain Ms. Callahan will probably be happy with that. I will contact her before this meeting is over and ask her.
So if you will provide that to us.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. So, Dennis Daniels. Is Dennis here? Thank you. If you'll come to the mic, please. Okay. Deborah, and I think it's Izuma.
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, I'm Officer Izuma. I work at Polk Correctional Institution. I'm pretty much echo what Officer Adams just said. Our department has gotten extremely dangerous in recent years. I've been with the agency about 20 years. Well, I've been with the agency a little over 20 years, and within the last, I would say two to three years, the assaults on staff and my. When I first came in, you could barely get an inmate to touch staff. Now it's nothing to touch a staff. I've had one of my trainees recently assaulted. I little girl, about 5 feet, but she defended herself until help got there. But the assaults on staff has been tremendous. And if there's anything, any changes that could be made to make our agency safer, no one at our agency, in our agency, is exempt. The males I work with, they have no problem touching female staff. It's off the chain with what they're doing. And so, if anything that you all can do to aid us in that, just support our agency, we welcome it. We welcome it. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Along that same subject matter, I would just like to share that, yes, indeed, this is, we all know this is a very dangerous job. Today, I think it was earlier this morning in Lanesboro, we had a correction officer who was involved in an incident with a couple of inmates. We don't have a report on him other than what I heard from Mr. Hooks, which was that he is in serious condition. It's a serious incident, and he had an artery that was cut. So we're waiting to hear, and hopefully, prayerfully, he's going to be okay. But I just wanted to make that extra emphasis that we're not talking past tense here. This is going on every single day, and it continues even to this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Steinberg. Representative Pasciali.
I'd like to ask Officer Azuma a question.
Yes, sir.
Ma'am, you said that you didn't used to have a problem with this. What changed, and who changed it?
That's a very good question, sir. What changed and who changed it? I can't really tell you. It's just been a decline. I mean, people are just not applying. They're just not applying. I don't know if it's the I'm sure money has a great deal to do with it. But what I have to ask myself is what made it change? When you come into our facility, when you come into any facility, you have to ask yourself, what is it you know now that you didn't know prior to coming in? Because you knew what you were going to be making, you knew what you were going to be wearing, you knew what days you were going to be working. So I would say the lack of control. The lack of control. I think we've taken a soft hands approach to dealing with these criminals, and they are criminals. We've taken a softer hand with dealing with them. And so that's what I would have to say. I've seen just in my 20 years, I've seen more assault on staff than I've seen within the last 3 years, and I've seen my 20-year career. In 1 month, 20-year career. In 1 week, 20-year career. I mean, you could even get an inmate to blow on me 20 years ago. It was a problem. It was going to be a problem. He blew on me. It was going to be a problem. Now he will step right up to you. I mean, that's a problem. And so I can't really answer. I mean, there's a laundry list of what some of the problems are.
Yes, but now remember, we have other speakers, so hey, if she wants to submit some offline response to your question, we can have her send us offline response and send it to everybody. I mean, if that's okay. Ms. Azuma, or Officer Azuma, would you feel comfortable submitting your response to the committee and then circulating it to the committee?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Representative Steve.
And Madam Chair, while she's doing that, I would ask that if any of them have suggestions on what we can do to help, since they're the on-the-ground people, not just what caused it, but what can we do to fix it?
Yes, ma'am, I think that's good. So for any of the speakers today or anyone else in the audience, if you want to submit something back to the committee, we will be grateful and we will be willing to accept any comments or responses that you have. Representative Steinberg.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I understand that they can, you've just said they can submit whatever comments they have. I know this is just to hear public comments, and we have just a very limited amount of time allotted to us. But it's important, I think, for the general public, not just for us as a committee to receive information. I think it's important for the general public who is here gathered, and I think for those who may be listening in or may be watching excerpts from this as we move forward today, to be able to hear the questions that are being generated by the individual members of the General Assembly and to hear the responses, to just say, you know, well, submit it and we'll take a look at it. That's not very transparent. Time or no time, I think our challenge is to continue or at least try to be as transparent as we can possibly be. We did not even have this agenda, and this is the second time this has happened. We did not have this agenda until late yesterday afternoon. And that's when the folks, and I mean the folks, that's when they knew we were going to be doing this. So they couldn't make any travel plans or anything to be here. You know, we've done some other things as it relates to where you can submit it on computer when we find out that 75% of the people who work in the Department of Corrections and in corrections don't have access to a computer. So, you know, I'm just making a statement. We're either here to get information and to hear what these folks are saying, what these folks have to say, or we're just here. I don't know why we're here. If we're not here for that, I don't understand why we're here. So I think we need to have that, give them the opportunity. If we've got legislators here who want to ask them questions, they need to stand for those answers. Please.
Thank you, Representative Steinberg. And I'm going to refer your inquiry to staff regarding the agenda and the online comments portion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a reminder, on the website, the Justice and Public Safety Oversight Committee website, there is a forum to submit comments, and the agenda has been on the website for over a week, and I'm sorry that some members didn't get that.
So the next person on the list, Brianna Knox.
Hey, I'm Officer Knox at Forsyth Correctional. I just wanted to say I work at a minimum unit, and I kind of feel like sometimes the minimum units are like overlooked, but we're dealing with the same type of inmate, and maybe I think a lot of the situations that are going on now are the different generation that we're getting of inmates, and you know, we want to kind of keep people in the same generation that can kind of like relate maybe, and keep everyone up to date on that. And I want to be brief and not say too many things, but they are getting more disrespectful because I didn't hear anyone else say that. And I agree with my fellow officers on all the things that they had to say. And I just ask for your support in providing funding for safety equipment to enhance safety to our staff. Thank you.
So I think it's Tommy Flowers. It looks like Tommy. Yes.
Hello. My name is Tommy Flowers. I work at Pasco Tank. I was not prepared for this, but I have to speak on behalf of my fellow officers, just as well as these ladies and gentlemen over here. I agree with of what they were saying. I feel that inmates sometimes have more rights than we do. They can say things and it's like they're right and we're penalized, or they're able to do, it's just relaxed. Y'all, excuse me when I say this, but it's like y'all pacify them and we get the end of it. We get the butt end. We're in trouble and we're trying to protect public safety. Who protects us? So there's a lot that I can say, so I'll respond with the rest later, but that's it. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Madam Chair, over here, Representative Pierce. Madam Chair, just like to make a statement, I won't hold because I know you got other folks. I'm going to take a tour tomorrow. I've got four facilities in my legislative district. And tomorrow I'll be going with Hope. I got with Mr. Lasseter with the department to set me up an appointment tomorrow. Because what happens, and I think some of these other members, a lot of folks call me at home. They send messages. They write letters. And the more I think about it, my wife retired from Scotland Correction after 25 years as the administrative officer there. The staff feels like nobody takes them serious. And we
sat here, and I mean, I'm not beating on anybody, but I just think it's so important that we as members at least go to these facilities and walk around and talk to, you know, it makes them, it's something about it, just, it makes them feel that somebody really cares, and that's why I've been to all my facilities in my district, and tomorrow I'll be going to Hope starting at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I want to hear what they really have to say. I don't mind staff trailing me, listen to what they're saying, but I think they ought to have the right to really let us know really what's going on. So I would encourage this committee, and I just want to just get that out. I'm in support of corrections all the way and all that they do. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Representative Pearson. I think you made that same statement last month, and you left, and then I commented how I encouraged our members to go visit their respective prisons or prisons that are close to their district, and I also recommended checking into the resource councils, because they have volunteer resource councils, and you can go in and work with the resource councils, or you can go in and work with the prison ministries.
Thank you. Thank you.
In some of the facilities. I don't know that you can get in all the facilities, but check those in your area, and you can learn more about what goes on in your respective prisons, and then you can make yourselves available to do whatever those prisons need. So I agree with you. I think it's very good to go into your prisons and, you know, see the conditions of the prisons and what the needs really are. So, next on the list is Larry Dial.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking time to hear us in corrections. My name is Larry Dial. I've been with the department for 35 years. The first 35 has been being in prisons, from a correction officer to a superintendent to an administrator, and a month ago was promoted to an Eastern Region Director with 12 prisons under my command. So I understand prisons. I understand we cannot operate without the support of you guys, and that's what I want to talk about. I really appreciate it. We're in a crunch, and we have a plan to get this ship turned around. And part of that is the visits. At the prison I was formerly at in Craven County, the legislator came in. We talked. There's been emails back and forth. And I can assure you now there has been some major purchase orders issued to buy some of the things that we had to have to make these prisons safer. So with your help, with my help, with these help, with the correction officers' help, we can get this turnaround and made into a safe environment. But it takes us all working together, and I challenge each of you legislators to go out and go into your prisons. Spend some time with them. You will find we are very accommodating, and we welcome the opportunity to show you what we do. The last thing I'll address is we talk about what is going on in prisons and what has changed over the years. When I came to prison, the first year I was there were several inmates killed. So violence has been in prison, but it's branched out into where it's touching the correction officers more so now. And a lot of that it goes back based on gangs and greed of these offenders that are coming in prison. So that's something we're looking at. We have started talking. One of our main things that we talk about when we meet is safety, security, and control. So as we have ideas, we will be getting them, going through the proper channels to get them up for your review. I thank you for your time.
Yes, I think you have a question from Representative Bowles.
Up here, thank you. I'm hearing from the officers that that if there's a disciplinary, could you explain to me what happens if a inmate assaults an officer?
Yes.
What happens?
Yes, sir, and that is taken very seriously. It's an A-class disciplinary offense, and we do all we can within prisons. And I'm glad you brought that up, because where we need some help is when it goes to the court system. I have carried inmates to court that assaulted a staff member. They get anywhere from 1 to 30 days, and we talk to district attorneys, and that's been improved. But we need support. Some of the comments that we get from DAs, well, you work in prisons. I had an inmate that bumped into a captain, knocked him down, and so we had to argue the point to get it in court. So we definitely need some support from my district attorneys when we have an officer that is assaulted. That is not part of any officer's, correction officer's job. That inmate needs to get the full fledged benefit or whatever the law says he can get.
And just a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So what I'm hearing you say is that you try to handle it within your administrative code, but if it's a serious enough criminal that you take out criminal, and it seems what you're telling me is that the court treats them, doesn't treat it with a seriousness of what it's supposed to be, as if they were not in prison.
Yes, sir.
And just follow up.
Yes, sir. Follow up.
And I hope that part of what Representative Steinberg and others have asked is recommendations as far as how we can hold other people accountable for the correctional officers. I mean, as far as protecting them, because if they report it, what happens if administratively you try to handle it? Are they transferred? Are they disciplined? Or what happens?
Yes, sir. We treat it at our level. We have a lot of internal controls to handle it, independent on the severity of the inmate. If it's, you know, if he assaults and there's staff injury, then we have control procedures that we place him on. We start on with 180 days and we review his actions. If they've improved, we may take him off and put him back in general population. But we look at each case individually.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Yes, Representative, let's see, which one raised your hand first? Floyd.
Madam Chair, I think that one thing that we need to look at, these are correctional officers, one. On the sidebar, then you have law enforcement officers. The correctional officers are not looked at as law enforcement officers. When you look at law enforcement officer and something similar happened, then the penalty is somewhat different. But I think that we have to look at correctional officers similar to law enforcement officer, and those penalties need to be sort of coincide or mirror.
Thank you. Representative Steinberg.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Kind of picking up where Representative Bowles left off, and I think he may have been asking the same question I have, or perhaps maybe making a similar comment. The thing that we seem to hear over and over and over again in the correspondence, I can speak for myself, in the correspondence that I receive, which is an enormous amount of correspondence from the correction officers, is that when there is, and I believe a couple of the officers alluded to this in their comments, when there is an interaction between the inmate and the correction officer, whether this is real or not, I don't know, but I can tell you perception is reality in the eyes of most who are experiencing it. And these officers, the bulk of them, don't feel as though when it comes down to whether whose fault was it, who's going to be reprimanded, that the reprimand all too often and the blame all too often, in their words now, is thrust into the faces of the correction officers. I don't, you know, if I heard that once or twice, that would be one thing, but we're talking about a broad section of people from across the state at all of the 55 correction institutions, and they're all saying the same thing. So we got a problem here. If the officers who are trying to carry out, keep these prisons safe, if they don't feel as though they're getting the cooperation, that no matter what action they take, that they're going to be wrong, that the inmate is going to be right. And can you address that, sir?
I can only address the ones I've dealt with, but with staff that I would deal with, when you look at use of force, there's three things you look at. First, is there an imminent threat of danger? Imminent threat of danger. Well, an inmate cussing you out is not an imminent threat of danger. If the inmate jumps toward you, it's an imminent threat of danger. The next thing we look at is, did the officer do what reasonably appears to be necessary? Was it reasonable to get this inmate under control? And then the third thing is, did we stop the use of force when we got the inmate under control? If you follow those three things, I can assure you at any prison in the state of North Carolina, you get full support of management.
So I'm going to thank you very much. I'm going to call on Susan Seitz, our staff attorney, and she's going to tell us the penalty for assaulting a correctional officer in current law.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The penalty actually depends on the nature of the assault and what, if any, injury occurs. The general assault of a state government officer is an A1 misdemeanor, assuming that there's no identifiable injury. If it is a physical injury is a Class I felony. Serious bodily injury is a Class F felony. If it is an assault with a firearm, it is a Class E felony.
Thank you, Ms. Seitz. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Floyd.
Yeah. Thank you for the information. But could she mirror that, as relates to a law enforcement officer at some later time and pass it along to us?
I think she's prepared now.
They are essentially the same. The probation officers, the parole officers, and the detention officers, I believe in all of the statutes, are essentially the equivalent as the law enforcement officer, and also most of them include North Carolina National Guard.
Thank you. Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question for Ms. Seitz and then a question for the gentleman, if I could go back to him. The question for Ms. Seitz is just when we're talking about officers, how is it classified if someone from the general public walks up and pushes me in this meeting? What type of assault offense is that?
That is what is colloquially referred to as a simple assault if you have no actual injury, because I believe in trying to get Jennifer to pull up the statute real quick. I believe that you are actually considered an officer of the state, so for you it would be an A1 misdemeanor. On the other hand, if it were me, who is not an officer of the state, I believe it is a Class 1 misdemeanor. So I believe you are elevated somewhat as a, it's 33.
Follow up.
As an officer.
Mm-hmm. Anything of Ms. Seitz?
No, ma'am.
Okay, so if we can have Mr. Dahl come back to the mic, please. And I think you're pronouncing your name Dale.
Yeah, yes, ma'am, but I answer about anything.
Mr. Dale, what's your official title?
I'm the Eastern Region Director of Prisons.
Okay, Director Dale, you mentioned about the decision about whether reasonable force was used.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
My question is, do we have people making that decision who have actually been corrections officers, or these administrators who don't know what it's like to serve in a prison?
You don't come in prisons as an administrator. Yeah, when you come through prisons, to give you my history, it was correction officer, lead officer, sergeant, lieutenant, captain, assistant superintendent 1, assistant superintendent 2, assistant superintendent 3, superintendent 3, superintendent 4, and administrator. And it's similar throughout the state. You don't come in one of these positions if you don't have corrections experience. We value education and it helps move you forward, but experience is what it takes to run one of these facilities.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bowles.
I want to follow, and I appreciate that. Is that a policy or is that the custom?
That's listed on the job postings. It tells you exactly what qualifications we're listing for, and they will be listed on that job postings.
Questions?
McNeil.
Yes, excuse me, Representative McNeil.
Thank you, Mr. Dale, and your work for the state of North Carolina and your long career.
is the inmate grievance procedure weighed too much in favor of the inmate and too much against the correction officer?
I say it's a fair system. Correction officers have to stop what they're doing. They have to write a statement. And we tell them if the inmate calls you a GDMFFOOO, whatever, you have to put that in your statement because that's what we got to address. We can't address it as the inmate cursed at me. We need to know what the inmate say so that we can say it. And then we need that officer to say I did or I did not. You will find, unless there is other circumstances, when we get that is sufficient to cover that grievance. Now, if we start in that grievance and there's another officer that says, yes, you did, or if there's other circumstances, then yes, we go further.
Follow up.
So an inmate can file a grievance against an officer for using a curse word?
Yes, sir. You can be dismissed for cursing an inmate.
Okay, but what happens to an inmate if he curses a guard? Or excuse me, a corrections officer?
We have a disciplinary offense which has actually been upgraded. After we had these tragedies, we looked at which direction we were going in, and we have made some dramatic changes in our policies to get more control back to the staff, back to the prisons, back to the correction officers. And that is one of the things we looked at. That charge, which used to be a C charge, was upgraded to a B charge, which is right next to the top serious charge that we have.
Follow up.
Thank you, and I appreciate it. It just seems to me like I understand there has to be some kind of procedure in there for inmates to have grievances.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one final question. When an inmate files a grievance, how quickly is that adjudicated? Does it drag on for months?
No, sir. When the inmate files a grievance, we have 3 days to accept it in and decide if he met our criteria. And then we have 15 days to get him to step one response. If he doesn't agree, then we have 20 days from that day to get him to step two response. And if he doesn't agree with that, then it goes to the grievance resolution board.
Just a comment. It seems like a system that's weighed in favor of the prisoner.
Madam Chair, at the conclusion of the gentleman, may I have a question, please?
For the set, yes.
At the conclusion of his briefing.
So I think Representative McNeil, I think you're finished, so Representative Floyd. Excuse me, Representative Speciale.
No, mine was at his conclusion. Are we through asking him questions?
No.
Okay.
Floyd.
Don't confuse Representative Floyd. I spent 20 years as a Marine. I can tell you, if we kicked everybody out that swore, you wouldn't have a Marine Corps. Where does that policy come from? Is that an internal policy? Is that something that the General Assembly put out? I mean, where did these types of policies come from?
Well, if you notice, I said you could be, you know. So we look at it. And, you know, sometimes taking corrective action is as simple as I get you. What's your name, sir? Okay, so now I've introduced myself. We're sitting there. We're talking. I get the correction officer in. I say, look, you know, that's not being a professional. That's not what we expect in this agency. I'm just counseling you today. So please, you know, remember who you are. Remember that you need to present that professional image, and that type of language does not need to be directed toward inmates. That it can be that simple. So, and we realize that. And you won't see it posted. You'll read it in the policy where it says that an officer that curses an inmate, that is dismissed for cursing an inmate, is subject to dismissal and not eligible for rehire. But it doesn't say, it gives us a leeway to determine how to go. Because how many in here have said a cuss word? How many have not ever said a cuss word? You know? Okay, all right, we got one. You know, so we have to look at that, and that's why we got to have experience so that we got people at the top that know how to wade through the middle and get to a good, solid conclusion.
Representative Floyd?
Well, this is now sort of introduced me to another question that we have as it relates to grievances. Now, if a person has a grievance, the grievance has been resolved, he or she is transferred to another institution only to have that grievance to come back alive. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
That he thought or she thought that it corrected that person. Hey. But when he goes back up, when she goes back up for promotion, he or she then find out that the grievance was not adjusted.
I have never known that to happen.
Follow up. Now, let me say, you never heard of a staff person that had a grievance that he or she thought that it was rectified.
Mm-hmm.
Only to find out when they're up for promotion, which is 2 or 3 years later, and plus your grievance procedure process, hold on, just a little bit longer than others.
Right.
Only to find out that it has not been resolved, and therefore they go back and then penalize that person, and he or she starts all over again new for a situation that occurred 2 years prior.
No, sir. We don't. The grievances and what happens in grievances comes into play in no way in the hiring process. Now, where it could come into play, if there was a grievance and it was found to have merit, then we would refer it to for what we call the Office of Special Investigations, where a separate entity investigates. And if the staff did something wrong, then it comes out in an investigation. Now, that may show up, but the grievance itself does not show up. But it's a complete, separate, detailed investigation.
I just wanted to say that, Madam Chair, I wanted to say that I have a little slight difference of opinion and thought about that, because the person was to be promoted only to find out that the incident was not rectified, that he thought it was rectified or she thought it was rectified, only when he or she was able to move, was attempting to move up, that's when it resurfaced again on his record. So it started back over with him or her at square one. Now, that's a system that needs to be looked at.
I think that's an incident that needs to be looked at. Now, a system doesn't work that way.
I beg your pardon, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yes, can you provide us with the internal policy that relates to the assault or the incidents, and then how you handle that in the grievance process?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Steinberg.
Yes, Madam Chairman, thank you. This is probably more of a comment than a question to anyone in particular, but I'm struck by the fact that in prisons, correction officers, we've been told over and over and over again, are dealing with the very, very, very difficult individuals in very difficult circumstances, and yet they are supposed to conduct themselves in interactions with these individuals like a parish priest. Now, to me, I mean, this is beyond the pale. We're talking about one of the roughest environments anywhere, and these folks are being harnessed and handicapped. I don't know what person could possibly act within the confines of never uttering a curse word at somebody that might be just throwing everything but the kitchen sink at them. Not only are they cited for that, that's troubling enough, and it's not even realistic, it's bizarre, but the fact that this is now on the correction officer's record, so that every time a promotion comes up or they have an opportunity for advancement, they have some of these inane, absolutely inane charges on their record. These may be very, very good correctional officers who are doing their job, trying to maintain control in a very difficult environment. And again, don't say Dan, don't say hell, don't point your finger at them, no matter what they're doing to you. That is just, as Representative Speciale pointed out, I mean, that is absolutely absurd. The only thing some of these folks understand is the same street language that they dish out. So they can respond, they may respond to that as opposed to no response at all, which is just going to escalate the situation. Just a comment. Thank you.
Thank you. So before we move on, we have received copies of the response from Megan Callahan's grandmother. So we're going to ask staff to go ahead and pass those out to the members so you all have those.
Her mother.
Is it mother? It says her. Pardon me? Oh, excuse me. It says that they've just lost their grandmother.
Her comments were from the mother. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
I want to just thank the staff for bringing to us how the two statutes parallel. But having spent a few years in EEOC, what I see is a policy on a statute that's on its face is neutral. But when we begin to implement that policy, it's somewhat different when it comes to correction officers. It's neutral in its stature. The statute itself, but the interpretation is somewhat different. I just want to make that.
So, Suzanne Beasley, can you tell us the full name of the person that submitted this statement?
Yes, ma'am. Her name is Wendy Callahan. She is Sergeant Megan Callahan's mother.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair.
Oh, yes.
Just a minute. I know you've got to move on. Does anybody in the department can talk just a minute about the Lanesboro? Could you entertain that or you just not at this time? I know they get ready to do some things.
We have five okay. more speakers, so if we could go through those, then we'll be glad to have the department answer any questions that you may have. So we have Kevin Holslaw.
Good afternoon. First of all, I'd like to start by saying I'm pretty much scared to death to be here. When I first started with the Department of Public Safety, I loved my job. I was there to serve my community, and I really enjoyed my job. I would like to ask, I have several notes here, and I know I'm going to miss something, so my main subject that I wanted to say before I lose my time frame is when a person commits suicide, people always ask the first question is why? What drove that person to do that? There's not a person in this room that can't tell me they don't know somebody that they didn't say why. Whenever society today, you see every day mass shootings on TV. The first thing they want to know is why. What caused this person to snap? Anybody that watches TV can't say they didn't want to know that answer. What I want to say to the committee today is they always say they were red flags. red flags that were brought forward that they missed, they didn't act upon. I can tell this committee today, I've got two folders that I have been begging for help since 2014. Documents that will absolutely blow your mind. Proof of how employees are meted, how they're treated with the DPS. This is not a story. This is not a hoax. This is the reason I walked away from my job after 10 years. I was here when they done the study. They presented the study. The guys from the prison get up and they say, we follow policy no matter what. Right here is going to show you different. I've got, they said, if you cannot go through your chain of command, you can contact the Eastern Region, the Western Region, the DPS hotline, human relations. They give a whole line of people that you can contact. Right here are the digital recordings of every person, every organization that was mentioned. I asked for help, and on this recording, it says, I'm 50 years old, and I'm scared to death. And I have yet. 3 days after an incident, 3 days after an incident, I have yet to get an answer. So when these people come forward and tell you they knew nothing of it, I have their voice, I have their name, and I have where they work. Now, with that being said, how many people in this room can say they have been on a yard locked in a fence, which I have, with 177 inmates and two officers? How many people in this room can tell me, when you're taking your tour as a legislator, that you are not being guided around with the posse and you're being protected? When you walk in that room, the first thing I'm going to ask you is, how many officers do you see? Because you ain't going to see three. Start counting them. It won't be three. It might be like 12. They're going to put on a show that you ain't never seen before. I said, I've got 2 minutes. My 2 minutes are going to concentrate on these folders that I've showed these documents to some people, and they're blown away. I also said in my 2 minutes, I'm going to invite the Associated Press. If this committee cannot look at this and say, wow, the man right here stood and said, this is who you contact, here they are. This is who you contact to prove your point. They won't nobody look at this. I went to 14 lawyers. Whoa, back up. Let me play this for you. Don't play that. I'm obligated. You know what that tells me? That tells me this committee, if you got lawyers that are scared to death of the state, I'm begging you to fix this. I'm begging you to fix this. I got officers who committed suicide where I work. I live with it every day. I said, I need help. On the recording, I'm 50 years old. I need help. Nothing. I wrote a letter to the White House. I got a letter from the White House. It says, we sent you a brochure on Stop the Bullying campaign. Are you kidding me? There are some serious problems. The man stood right here in front of this committee. The question was asked by Bob Steinberg. How much of this includes from the supervisor up? How much of that was covered? The answer was none. And I'm telling you right here, two folders I can prove. Now, some of the people in this room have seen me. They blew me off. Their name's on this reporting. They're going to say, I didn't know nothing about it. Well, when we hit play, you're going to be surprised. This ain't a joke. It's open. I said, here's what I can do. July the 1st. If I ain't heard nothing, I want the Associated Press to handle it because everybody's off for the 4th of July. I loved my job. But when my friends are killing themselves because they're being bullied, I can't take it. I can't take it. I no longer work. I can't work. I can't watch TV. Watching Oprah Winfrey the other night. Bam, here's a man swinging from a bed or swinging from a sheet. Inmate got bullied at the prison, put him in the back. He committed suicide. Guess who found him? They want to play games. I pay the price. They took another young officer to the front office, chewed her up one side and down the other. I said, look, I've seen that look before. If you people ain't seen the look of a 1,000-yard stare, you never want to see it. Now, guess what? I do it now. I do it now. I tried to speak to that young lady. I said, I will do whatever it takes to get you some help. Let me help you. I got a phone call the next morning. Did you hear about the officer? No, what's going on? She shot herself last night. She killed herself. Whenever I come in today, and I'll respectfully say, I had people that were coming with me, current employees. I'm glad they're not here because to me, the intimidation, you're taught when you go through school, you're taught firm, fair, and consistent with all inmates. When I worked with officers and they said, that's a child molester, I said, that's an inmate. He's a human. You're not here to judge him. You're not here to prosecute him. You're here to protect him and all other inmates. That's your job. You're not here to pass judgment. You're here to protect him as well as you. I personally was surrounded the entire block at Alexander Correctional Institute. Had a guy came in. The guy spoke about we're going to work with the National Guard, Marines, whoever we can get in here. Let me tell you something. The guy's first day on the job, he was a Marine. He was a drill instructor. And he might as well walked in there. It was like a hornet's nest. He said, ladies, the man told you to move. You don't walk into a room full of inmates that are in there for life and say, ladies. Because immediately, there's always a guy that runs a block. There's always a guy that charges rent to the guys that are coming in. This guy comes running from the back. He's the one in charge, and he's running at me. The reason he's running at me is because I done my job. I stepped in front of that officer, and I guarded that officer with my life. I didn't know him. I just met him. He just come in that day. He's a drill instructor. And they said, let me have him. Let me have him. I said, the guy that ran the block. I said, look, let me tell you something. This ain't about this ain't me and you. This ain't about me and you. This, I said, I'm going to ask you something. I'm going to ask you to look at who I am. You know me. You've dealt with me for 2 years. I said, I'm going to ask you to turn around, put your hands behind your back, and allow my sergeant, who had came in the room, to put cuffs on you and take you to segregation until you calm down. And he looked at me and he turned around, he put his hands behind his back, and he went to segregation. I said, now I will give you my word right here in front of my sergeant. You've done nothing. If my sergeant doesn't release you in an hour, I will resign. The word in prison is respect. I actually had heard it in this room the last time I was here. You play jokes on an inmate. You take one card out of the deck. You take one shower shoe. That's what causes problems, folks. I can tell you right now, I just spoke with Officer Adams. I said, I can tell you how to shut down the yard to where nobody, no officer can get in that yard, because if you're gonna fix what's going on with an inmate, you got to think like an inmate. And I told him how I would do it, and he was blown away. I said, these guys talked about replacing the radios. Let me give you a quick scenario on my thoughts on a radio. Think of a different type radio is what I'm asking. Everybody, state troopers, you always see it's really pretty. I tell the inmates, I work for the sheriff's department. They put the radio up here over their shoulder. The guys at the sheriff's department said, why do you do that? And I said, do you really want to know why I do that? And they said, yeah. And I done just like it right there. And I took that radio and I had it wrapped around his neck, both jugular veins. And I said, you sure are pretty. And every officer took their radio clip and put it right here. I had something to teach. I had knowledge to pass on, and I had to resign. I had to resign because nobody wants to see this. You guys have a good day.
I'm going to ask Representative Ball. Is it a question or anything? Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are we through?
So I think Representative Bowles is saying finish the public comment before he proceeds with his inquiry. So we have Cola Holskall.
Thank you, Senator Randleman, and thank you, members of the committee, for allowing us to speak. My name is Artis Watkins. I am with the State Employees Association of North Carolina, and we have been doing a lot of talking to our members who work as correctional personnel all across the state. Just as Representative Steinberg alluded to earlier, you hear the same stories whether you're talking to someone way into the mountains or as far east as Representative Steinberg is. We've got a little over, I think, maybe one more than half of the committee's here right now. And we're a bit over an hour into it. And Senator Randleman, I appreciate more than you know the fact that you had public comment at this meeting. You know, Ms. Callahan has been here for, every meeting y'all have had and has been anxiously awaiting that day. And I hate that they had the other death in their family that prohibited her from being here. But there are a lot of people who would come and speak. And that is a big statement to make because people have been afraid to talk. But they would. The problem is they need more notice than this. And apparently, I think it's probably true of a lot of people. Everybody has a lot going on. But I am dismayed. This is a huge issue. Five people were murdered last year. We can't say it enough. We just talked about one of them was stabbed this morning in an artery in serious condition. And when we hear these things at this point, we're just kind of blank. This is just what we're expecting to hear at this point. I would beg of this committee that you have a meeting with a lot of advance notice, because these officers and these other correctional personnel have a difficult time getting off if they can at all. There's so much mandatory overtime right now from what I'm hearing. And unless people are lying across the state, there's tons of mandatory overtime, and a lot of folks are booked through November. Their calendar's booked for them for work. And so if we could have a good amount of time notice, I think you could get people here to tell you things that would shock you. Since 2011, 12 prisons have been closed. When we stand here and say, I don't know why this is happening, I don't know why we're saying, I don't know why this is happening. I want to be clear. Scenic nor our members blame the current legislature. This has been going on. I've been lobbying for 18 years on state employee issues. This has been going on almost as long as that we've seen these things progressing. I don't blame anybody that's running the Department of Public Safety, because this has been going on a long time. But moving forward, we are every single one of us to blame if we don't do everything we can to jump up and down and bring attention to this issue. If you don't do whatever you can to make sure the folks are heard from that work inside, and yes, it's going to be really expensive. Closing those 12 prisons saved us some money, but I can't imagine what it's cost us in payments to inmate families, to inmates, to officer families, to officers, and that's not counting the very real cost of the human lives. It is time to take a very serious look at this. We would ask that you have some sort of select committee appointed. I think there's some of you that are really very dedicated to these issues and would do an amazing job, and we could get a tremendous amount of public input for you. I appreciate all of your time today, and we look forward to talking a lot in the future about this issue.
Thank you, Artis. So, Colby Crandall.
Greetings, everyone, to the Oversight Committee and all the members and people that are here to participate. This is a very big issue. My name is Colby Crandall. I am born and raised in Pequimis County, North Carolina, Hereford. So I have lost a personal friend due to what is going on in the prison system. But I would like to kind of speak to the rehabilitative side, because I haven't heard no one address that. I think a lot of personal opinion, a lot of the inmates issue are due to response to how they respond to CEOs, is how they personally feel about themselves and how they personally feel about their future once they leave prison. You know, we do have, I want to say thank you to all for establishing a local reentry council. I think that was a very good idea for you all to, choose to do that. But I would like to recommend that, you know, more support come around the local LRC. Ms. Sullivan and Vincent Gaddy, they're doing a fantastic job, in my opinion, of trying to get that off of the ground and running. So what I would like to see personally, and be before you long, is that this body create a collaborative process that lays down the tracks which leads to the success of each individual in pursuit of change. So thank you for your time, and I look forward to seeing what y'all do next. Thanks.
Thank you. So we have one last speaker, and it's John Swade.
I'll be real quick. The first thing I want to say after Mr. Holtzclaw's comments are, everybody should know, is that prison employees, generally, we know about the bad ones that make it to the newspaper. My name is John Schwade, JohnSchwade. I'm going to ask you to Google that later. Prison employees generally are far more honorable and far more compassionate than anybody would imagine. I was a prison psychologist for over 2 decades, and it was corrections officers and sergeants who were the ones who were able to identify the people with the serious mental illness who made it through the screens. Some of them were so ill that they didn't even realize that there was anything wrong with them. Their delusions were real to them. So when somebody asked them to fill out a questionnaire or ask them questions like, do you hear voices? If you ask me if I heard Senator Randleman's voice a minute ago, I wouldn't tell you that means I'm schizophrenic. A couple quick things. Mr. Dale said earlier that after these tragedies, we look at our disciplinary policies and talked about some revisions that were made. But I have to point out that the revisions that were made, the upgrade of certain offenses that went into effect on January 3rd, 2018, were actually a revision of a disciplinary policy sans almost all discipline that went into effect last June 17th, less than 2 months after Sergeant Megan Callahan was murdered. And so the idea that after these tragedies we look at things and make the prison safer, that has not been true for the past year. And I don't question how certain people, if they come up here and say how they operate, I'm in no position to question them. But I will tell you that the dirty tricks involved are mind-boggling. There is a war on staff. I had to put a guy on the floor once, and I did it very gently because I've been lifting weights for 50 years, and I simply picked him up by the back of his jumpsuit and laid him on the floor. And then officers came in and handcuffed him. And I later found out they were all written up because the guy was on the floor. The guy tried to headbutt me. Has anybody here been headbutted recently? If you are, let me know. One of the dirty tricks that's used routinely if they want to get somebody is if there's a use of force, there is often a video record of that, okay? And they will ask the officer then to write a statement, and if their statement doesn't correspond point for point with what's seen on the video, they get written up for falsifying documentation. Well, let me tell you something. 10 years ago in Durham, I stopped a knife assault, okay? And the guy who was pulling the knife, he was trying to assault an old man, and he ended up face down bleeding. And afterwards, after I talked to the police, who didn't charge me, I had to ask my daughter what happened. That's how it goes in a real fight. So I want you to carefully consider what the officers are telling you. And one last thing I would ask you, when you get a written report, I know there are new members of the committee, but last February, I sent every member of the who was then on the committee an 18-page report in which I predicted much of what's happened, including the increase in danger. We just had the therapeutic diversion unit at one prison closed down. That there's only a handful of inmates left in these TDUs, which were ballyhooed, okay? Not one member of the committee responded, but what did happen is for the last 14 months, I have been contacted by current prison employees, I'm retired, from all over the state, and there's a lot that they will not say here, and there's a lot I won't say here. I think that Representative Steinberg's proposal that there be a commission or committee with subpoena power is going to be necessary to get to the bottom of it. Thank you.
Thank you. So is there anyone else here that wishes to speak? Seeing none, I will proceed and recognize Representative Bowles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had invited someone from the governor's office today. Are they here? Is the secretary of DPS? I see Mr. Deputy Secretary, Mr. Judge Young. If I could ask a question, please.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. First, I'd like to welcome you to the committee and thank you for what you're doing, and I'm glad you're on board.
Thank you very much.
And the concerns that are going on, and I know that some of the NIC report, that those recommendations are being put in place, and we had a briefing on that last month. But I'd just like to ask it is that at this point in time, has there been any conversations or discussions with Governor Cooper as to the administration's position on the death penalty, in which it has been imposed as a result of death of a correctional officer in the carrying out of their duties, and if so, if it's imposed by a North Carolina jury?
All right, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Reuben Young. I serve as the interim chief deputy secretary for the Division of Adult Corrections and Juvenile Justice. Mr. Representative, in response to your question, I can tell you that I have not had a conversation with the governor with regard to the subject matter that you have mentioned. And I would not speculate with regard to what the governor's position would be.
Follow up.
Thank you.
So, thank you for being here today, and I have one question.
Yes,
so I know the governor's office appointed, or the I think it may have been Secretary Hicks appointed, the North Carolina Prison Reform Advisory Board.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you a member of that board?
I am not a member of that board, but I did attend the first meeting and will attend the other meetings as they are scheduled.
So when was the board formed, and when were the members appointed?
I don't know that I can give you the specifics of that. I do know that towards the end of last year, the secretary called for a prison reform board, and I do think over the month subsequent to that, members started to be appointed.
And they have met?
Yes, ma'am, they have.
So I think the question is, do you know how many times they have met?
They have met one time, and they are scheduled to meet three more times this year.
So does that mean they're meeting quarterly?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you as well.
Representative Stevens.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask Mr. Young if there are any members of the General Assembly on this advisory committee, considering we may be the one that need to make some legislative changes.
No, ma'am, not that I'm aware of.
Ms. Chair.
I am looking at the names on the committee, and they are not. But I'll have staff put the names of the committee on the website so you can see who the committee members are.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Just for clarification, this is a committee appointed by the governor, not the General Assembly.
Thank you, Mr. Bowles. I just wondered why he wouldn't want someone who actually makes the law and does the funding to be on that committee.
Well, that's why we're asking. I agree with you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Just for clarification, the members of the Prison Reform Board were appointed by the secretary and not by the governor.
So was that at the direction of the governor?
No, ma'am. It was by the secretary.
Okay.
I'm assuming that it was done by the auspices of the governor, but the secretary made the appointments.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you as well.
So, committee members, that will cause us to move on into the next segment on the agenda. And if you will recall, last month we had invited Chief Justice I. Beverly Lake to come, and he was not able to come at that time. And once again, we had postponed that to this month, and that invitation was extended again as a courtesy to Chief Justice Lake. And he is not in a position to come. And so they have submitted written comments and recommendations, and we're just asking that those be included in our report. So on your agenda, we're going to jump around a little bit, if that is acceptable with the committee and without seeing any objection. We do have a subcommittee, the Subcommittee on Alcoholic Beverage Commission, the report, and I am going to call on Senator Wells.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The JPS Oversight Subcommittee on ABC Permitting met several times since our appointment late last year. This was a very focused effort. You have in your packets a history of shootings outside bars in Hickory over the last year, which left three bars Five bodies. That's not a reflection on my district. I think most of those were visitors. We have had continuing conversations as a subcommittee. The subcommittee included Representative Turner Jackson and myself. We've had ongoing conversations with ABC, ALE, local law enforcement, to try to get a grip on how we deal with situations like this and why those bars remain open after events like this happen. And in working with Renee Metz at ABC, the conclusion was that there were required statutory changes to give them the authority to take appropriate action after significant events. And you have in your package a bill that it was approved by the subcommittee, TQ 36 version 3. And I'd like to present that today.
So you're going to explain the bill, or you want staff to explain the bill?
I will explain the bill in broad terms, and staff mm-hmm. will be available for questions. Mm-hmm. This was a narrow focus. This was not intended to get into wholesale changes of Statute 18B. This was very narrow. How do we stop bad actors from continuing to sell alcoholic beverages in the state of North Carolina? On the first page, there are a couple of changes under Section A and B. Those were simply CPI adjustments from fines that had not been adjusted since 1982. On page 2, it turned out that you could own a bar for 2 years before you could buy an alcoholic beverage. So that is a change to reflect ownership at age 25. Again, at the request of ABC. On page 3, under section, we're still under section 2, but at the top of page 3, there was apparently a loophole in the statutes that you could put together an ownership group, and if each of the owners was less than 24%, that is, if you got enough owners, none of them had to be a qualifying owner. So this puts in place that 51%. At 51%, somebody has to qualify. Page 4 is intended to be a clarification. That is not an opening of the door for local governments to ignore Dillon's rule and come up with additional zoning considerations. Our intent was to place all the zoning land use regulations under one category in an effort to simplify and clarify the law. On page 5 is where we got into some interesting conversations that are continuing. There is some issue about that concerned ABC and their enforcement about revoking a permit to sell alcoholic beverages. That is, and there's an ongoing debate here about whether selling alcoholic beverages is a privilege or a right. And there is inside that section, we have had continuing conversations, as has ABC, with ABC and Office of Administrative Hearings. Those, as I say, those continued through today. We had some changes proposed. What ABC had suggested is, along with their changes, a change to change the revocation, the immediate revocation of a license after, say, a shooting from 30 days to 3 days, as there seemed to be a constitutional issue. I think Representative Turner has an amendment, if we could go ahead and run that. While those discussions continued, our subcommittee approved the bill to reduce that 30-day suspension to a 3-day suspension. But while these conversations continue, and since they have not been finalized, we would like to run an amendment to erase that change in the proposed bill.
Representative Turner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment has been distributed to the committee, and we submit it for approval.
So, committee members, the amendment would be 2017-TQ-36 version 3, and everyone should have a copy. Anybody need a copy? There it is.
And as a comment,
yes, ma'am.
Senator Wells has already described this, but it basically just reverts it back to where it was because we're not ready to move forward with the change of days.
Thank you. Do I hear a motion to
Yes,
Representative Bowles.
Clarification, this is where current law, which is under appeal, I think, correct, is that it's taken away 30 days, and this is where you can shut it down for 3 days, and then they can open back up. And if I could get clarification from ALE that's out here.
Senator Wells,
and
do you have response?
Or staff? Well, as I understand it, ABC had requested this change from 30 to 3 because of the challenge.
Right.
And the subcommittee left it in there. But we feel like there may be an alternative fix, and we'd like the time to work through that fix. In the meantime, we were not prepared to reduce that 30 days to 3 days at this time.
Right.
And I'd leave, would like to leave the exact existing statute in place.
Okay. Now, just if I, as far as ALE, I think, is here, if that's their same interpretation.
Someone from ALE want to come forward?
And also, Senator Wells, were they part of this discussion as well? Okay.
So if you will identify yourself, please.
Madam Chair, Terrence Merriweather, branch head for ALE. In reference to this particular issue, we worked out with ABC, and it's one of our concerns as well, and they have struck this particular language for the 3 days. So we're okay with the 30 days being enacted. One of the concerns that we had on the ALE side was actually putting the work into serving this and working with ABC and working with the particular location. If it was served on a search warrant was served on a Friday or Saturday night, enough time for us to do a violation for unsuitable to hold was typically 7 days. So that location would be able to open back up on the following weekend, which was a concern.
I guess my concern is that this is a tool you can work with.
Absolutely. The way it is was currently written, yes, sir.
Okay. And it sounds like, Senator Wells, you need a local bill instead of a state bill in Hickory.
if I may, Madam Chair, two issues there. This is not a Hickory area. I'm seeing this happening across the state now that I'm tuned into it, but I would tell the committee and the chairs, I am having ongoing regular conversations with both ALE and local law enforcement on this issue. They are actively engaged in this conversation.
And a comment, I'm glad you're, because I've been engaged with them for years, and that's why we impose those laws, and it is a concern statewide. It is a major concern, and these gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, they need all the resources that they need to stop the bad actors.
If I may continue, Madam Chair.
Senator Wells.
Well, as it relates to Section 4, our intent, I've talked to Judge Mann at OAH within an hour. We are going to continue that conversation and see if we can get tools in place for revocation that meet constitutional challenges and get these bad actors out of the way as quickly as possible over major offenses. On the next section.
So, Senator Wells, I think we need to vote the amendment first. Does everyone have a copy of the amendment? Any further questions on the amendment? Hearing none, do we have a motion to adopt the amendment?
So moved.
Second? Do we hear any objection to adoption of the amendment? Seeing none, we have adopted the amendment.
On section,
Senator Wells.
On Section 5, since some of these bad actors are in private clubs, this was a change requested by ABC, but at some direction that we look at what surrounding states are doing around this issue of private clubs. And what the change does in Section 5 at the bottom of page 7, it says that a private club is a private club if it qualifies as a 501c3 under the IRS code and has been in operation for a minimum of 12 months in order to, before they apply for an ABC permit. This does grandfather all existing clubs.
So, excuse me, did you?
I would ask for your support, and I'm available for questions. Your staff might be better for the more.
Yeah, let's have staff kind of do a general review of the bill as to the changes in the bill more precisely.
Madam Chair, Senator Wells did hit most of the key points of the bill. As he mentioned, Section 1 just increases the dollar amounts authorized for some penalties, as well as authorizes the commission to impose conditions on the operation hours of a business as a penalty. Section 2 requires that any owner of the business be at least 25 years old, any owner of a business seeking to sell alcoholic beverages be at least 25 years old to qualify for a permit. And then that also contains the condition he mentioned about requiring at least 51% ownership to qualify for a permit. Section 3 is the clarifying change he mentioned to relocating some of that language all to the zoning laws together. Section 4, again, as he mentioned, is directing Office of Administrative Hearings and an Administrative Law Judge to make some decisions that currently the Commission makes. And we've adopted the amendment to change page 6, line 9, so that will stay 30 days. And then Section 5, I believe Senator Wells unintentionally misspoke, that it would apply to anyone that is a 501c. Not just a 501c3. So it is a little bit broader than C3. It's just a 501c. But you would have to be a 501c to qualify as a private club. And other than that, the effective date would generally be effective October 1 for the first portion, and the rest of it would be when it becomes law.
Questions on the bill? Yes, Representative McNeil.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Are these bills just for introduction to us today to look at, or are we going to vote them out today?
These will be considered for our committee report. They will be included in our committee report once we adopt the report.
So we're not going to vote on these bills today. We'll vote on them when we do the committee report.
Well, we're going to vote on the committee report today. It will be voted out today with these included in the committee report if the committee so adopts the report.
Okay, well, I have since we're going to do these today, I thought if we weren't, then I wouldn't ask these questions. But I have a question then on this bill.
So, Representative McNeil, the bills coming out in the report, they will still have to be filed and go through the normal hearing process. So if there are any modifications to the recommendations, then you would be welcome to do that in any committee that these bills are referred to.
Thank you, but I do have one quick question then, like, clear something up.
Yes, sir.
All right. On the first one, where you're imposed conditions on the operation hours of the business, I understand that. That's pretty straightforward, but it seems a little broad. I just wonder if this is directing the agency to come up with some guidelines so that you're not restricting one business and hours in Asheville in a certain way and one in Wilmington in a certain way. So this seems a little broad. What guidelines are they going to use when they decide how they restrict their hours?
Senator Wells.
And so, you know, I will tell you how that came about, and we have two folks. Renee Metz could not be here today, but Agnes Stevens and Missy Welch are here from ABC, and they may be able to speak to their internal. But as I understand it, ABC has a broad range of guidelines on a number of things, including various offenses and which one of the, whether it was the first, second, or third time, so on, that you engage in those offenses. So they've got a grid on penalties that I understand that they use across the state, hopefully consistently and evenly. The reason this came up is a simple question I had. You've got an operation acting like a restaurant. That is, the 30% of their sales come from food. Everything goes along just fine. Everything's great until midnight.
And I said, so if you're having problems at 1 or 2 in the morning and everything's just great until 11:30, why don't you limit their hours? And they said they did not have the statutory authority to do that. And this gives them that statutory authority. I would, that commission has the availability to do a lot of things within their existing penalties. So, I mean, the question you raise is a valid one and could happen across any penalty. But what this was meant to do, again, getting the focus on bad actors, if somebody, perfectly fine establishment before midnight, problem after midnight, then limit their license to before midnight. That's how that came about.
Thank you. And I'm not opposed to limiting the hours. I just want to make sure there's some process in place, whether it's something we write into this bill or we give ALE and ABC Commission the authority to make those so that they're applied consistently across the state to everybody and that one's not punished worse than another for the same things, as long as it's done consistently. And if the way this is written allows that to be done, then I'm fine with restricting their hours. That's not the issue.
Judge Warren, you want to speak for the ABC?
No.
Yeah, so someone from the ABC like to speak. Thank you, Judge Warren, for offering. If you would, please state your name, and I'll have Representative McNeil to ask the question to you, or if you would like for him to repeat.
Good afternoon. I'm Attorney Missy Welch. I'm Assistant Counsel for ABC Commission.
And I'm Agnes Stevens. I am Deputy Director at the ABC Commission.
Representative McNeil, if you want to restate your question, please.
I assume you have a copy of the legislation, correct? And you're aware of the section that I'm referring to where it just says impose conditions on the operation hours of the business. So my question is this. Is that sufficiently stated in the law to give you what you need to do, and do you have policies and procedures in place, or can you adopt policies and procedures that comply with what the way this is written so that any business that's regulated, whose hours are regulated, is consistent across the state of North Carolina so that one business is not regulated any harsher than another? I'm not opposed to regulating hours. I think that's fine. I think it's wonderful. Let's make sure it's done consistently and fairly across the state.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Senator Wells recapped it exactly right. We do need this tool. We don't have the authority right now. We would anticipate that we would develop guidelines that are similar to the penalty guidelines that are in place now for suspensions and fines. We have not developed those guidelines because we haven't had the authority, but we think that the way it's presented is appropriate.
And similar to the guidelines, the penalty guidelines that we use to impose for ABC violations, it would be an internal policy that we could use. Similar to what Senator Wells mentioned, if we do see that these issues are occurring or these ABC violations are occurring around set hours or set time where imposing the condition on the operation hours would be effective, then we can obviously do so with those guidelines.
Okay. Any other questions for the ABC Commission from the members? Mr. Smith, you got one? Okay. Thank you. And if I could ask ALE Director, just to ask if these are tools that will help you, and if you're able to, or you're going to be able to implement these, or and if there's any others that would help, that you would get up with Senator Wells between now and the final draft of introduction of bills.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And if you just like to comment, or you're okay
just,
with
just
it.
Just comment on the tools itself, Mr.
Chairman. If you would identify yourself, please. I'm sorry.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Again, Terrence Merriweather, branch head for ALE. First, very appreciative of Senator Wells reaching out, understanding the troubles in which we encounter actually in the public, and making sure that that people can go to ABC locations, ABC licensed outlets with their families and be safe. So I applaud you, and I'm very appreciative for you taking on this stance and trying to enhance this particular bill to give us get more teeth into it for the bad actors, as you say. But I'll continue to work with, and the staff will as well, with Senator Wells and the committee to make sure our input is given. And he has reached out, and we're very grateful for that, for Senator Wells. But I will continue to do that, to reach out to him and make sure that, that everything that we need or we're requesting is put in here, or he's aware of it as well.
Thank you, Mr. Director. And I guess my concern is that we implement the policies and the legislation, and the ABC Commission exercises theirs, but you guys are the ones that have to implement it and put it to use.
Well, just in reference to the last one, I understand when you're talking about hours operations, one of the concerns that come forth, and obviously dealing with the ABC Commission, if crimes continue to occur at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, understanding the bill as it's written and the hours of limitations, preventing those particular acts from happening at that same location if it continues to happen at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. So I understand the intent of the law, and yes, we would be able to apply and utilize it if it's implemented.
Thank you. And I guess my concern is we want to give you good tools that you can use.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Packwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may, sir, there are in our state several agencies that can enforce what we call ABC regulations, or alcoholic beverages and so forth. One being ALE. One used to be the ABC board, but they do not have enforcement officers now, I don't think, do they?
There are some counties that actually still have ABC.
At the county level?
Yes, sir.
Okay, county ABC, ALE, and local police departments, local sheriff's departments, they can also enforce it?
Most are they're contracted with the ABC Commission.
Okay. Let me ask you what the relationship in terms of operation out there in the field on Friday night when things are going on, what's the interaction between ALE and the sheriffs and the local police? Can you give us an example of how you work together or what your responsibilities are?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that we continue to do, and since being in this position, is continue to work with the Sheriff's Association with the needs from ALE. We just recently reached out to the ABC local boards, and we are starting a new task force to deal with the violence that continue to occur at ABC license outlets. To get rid of these bad actors. So ALE and ABC are partnering together. We made a commitment to be stronger together, because it doesn't make a difference who get the bad guy off the street. Our job is to get the bad actors, so to speak, off the street. So we continue to partner with the local ABC, partner with our sheriff's office and local police departments as well.
Thank you for that. And follow up. What are the other responsibilities of ALE?
Well, there are a lot. Typically, in the General Assembly, we're given a lot of responsibility, and of course, we'll act whatever you give us. We have tobacco enforcement that we do, a contractual agreement with Department of Health, DHHS, and we have lottery responsibilities as well, gambling enforcement that we have, an array of responsibilities within ALE, more than just alcohol law enforcement. When you say the word alcohol in itself, it's more than that. So we're actually going into locations, getting bad things out of these stores. For example, unprescribed or unlicensed or fictitious or fake medicines that are occurring in some of these places as well. Making sure that we're doing our job to protect the citizens of the state and of the county in which you're representing as well.
Follow up. Would it be fair to say that ALE probably has the broadest jurisdiction in terms of enforcing the criminal laws of any of our organizations?
That I'm aware of, I think it would be fair to say.
Follow up. Who do you answer to, sir?
I answer to Director Schirmeier, which is my supervisor, which he's over the State Bureau of Investigation. And that's or ALE falls up under the State Bureau of Investigation. We're a branch within.
Follow up. Where is that structure set out?
The structure in itself, we're a section or branch within the State Bureau of Investigation. So Director Schirmeier is my direct report. I report directly to Director Schirmeier.
Follow up. How did that take place? How did that particular relationship take place?
It was a legislative action that occurred, I believe it was in 2014.
That the ALE was placed under SBI?
Correct, yes, sir.
Thank you. No further.
Representative Turner.
Madam Chair, this is not a question. I just wanted a clarification. Do you need a motion to include our bill into the report?
We're going to make a motion to include. We have three bills that will be included in the report, but thank you. And I have one question. So when you talk about gambling, and I know you do have broad authority, but when you talk about gambling, you have some specific authority over, say, like bingo, those kinds of things. Can you speak to that?
We do. We are actually responsible for enforcing the bingo laws as well. But we actually have now a new supervisor that actually that responsible for all the gambling laws, which is Special Agent in Charge Chris Poole. So if you're referring to what the statutes are or the laws are on bingo, or just that we enforce bingo laws?
No, I was trying to ask what your concentration is. If you concentrate on those statutory things, or if you go outside of the statutory gambling, such as sweepstakes parlors. You know, do you go into a sweepstakes parlor even though they don't sell alcohol, or do you just go into any sweepstakes parlor?
So typically when you talk about bingo, they would have actual permit for that. When you talk about the outside parlors, what we do is typically we get into relationships with our sheriff and police chiefs, where we're called into, because of the expertise of ALE, to work in these particular establishments.
And I think in some jurisdictions you may have MOUs with some of the local law enforcement agencies.
Well, we wouldn't have an MOU. We would have original jurisdiction there to be able to work these particular cases. But what we are doing is continue to partner with the sheriff's office and police chiefs where they need our assistance.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So we'll go back to the sexual assault evidence collection kit law enforcement inventory report, and I will call on Dr. John Byrd.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to come speak to you and the members of Public Safety, the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety. And on behalf of Attorney General Josh Stein, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present the 2017 Sexual Assault Evidence Collection Kit Law Enforcement Inventory Report and recommendations from the Department of Justice. In this presentation, Legislative Liaison Bradford Sneeden and I will present information that will be helpful to you as we work together to address this critical issue. In North Carolina, and Madam Chair, I would just tell you this next little section is a bit of a primer on sexual assault kits, but I thought it was important to set the context. In North Carolina, sexual assault kits are created by a vendor under contract with the Department of Public Safety. The kits are assembled in accordance with specifications determined by the State Crime Lab based on best forensic practices and in consultation with forensic medical practitioners. What you see before you are the contents of a sexual assault evidence collection kit. Medical facilities across the state receive the kits from the vendor for use during the forensic medical examination of patients reported to have been the victim of a sexual assault. Often the examination is conducted by specialized sexual assault nurse examiner, or a SANE, and sexual assault kits can be generated in connection with either a sexual assault that is reported to law enforcement or one which is unreported. Unreported kits are often referred to as anonymous kits. The Federal Violence Against Women Act requires withholding of federal funding from entities that do not protect the anonymity of sexual assault victims who wish to seek treatment but choose not to report a criminal offense to law enforcement. So unreported or anonymous kits may be stored in a facility provided by the Department of Public Safety. Reported sexual assault evidence collection kits are turned over to law enforcement for further investigation. The physical evidence collected will often be submitted to a forensic laboratory for testing to include trace evidence, a serology examination, and/or DNA examinations. Subsequently, one or more laboratory reports will be provided to the submitting agency, the district attorney's office, and to a defendant, if there is one, through the discovery process. Forensic DNA matches may result from the comparison of an unknown DNA profile from the kit with a known DNA standard taken from a suspect, a victim, or an elimination standard, such as a consensual partner. Sometimes a DNA match occurs with a suspect known to the victim. Other times, the DNA profile from the sexual assault evidence collection kit may be from a person unknown to the victim, but this profile later hits to a criminal offender's profile or to a profile from another case that has been uploaded to CODIS, or the Combined DNA Index System database. When such hits take place, law enforcement is directed by the reporting laboratory to submit a known standard for the offender to confirm the forensic match. Ladies and gentlemen, CODIS is a powerful tool for investigative leads in unsolved sexual assault cases where the offender may have committed sexual assaults against multiple victims, such as serial offenders. And CODIS participating DNA laboratories in North Carolina include the State Crime Laboratory in Raleigh and the soon Western Regional Laboratory, which will soon come online with DNA, and the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department Crime Lab. As a criminal investigation progresses, the investigating law enforcement agency or district attorney's office may determine that a sexual assault evidence collection kit should not proceed to forensic testing. The reasons given for this decision vary greatly, specific to each case, often due to information the victims provide. As a refresher, the legislative directive provided in session law last year is on the screen. Local law enforcement agencies were directed to inventory and report all of their untested sexual assault evidence collection kits within their custody to the State Crime Lab by December 31st, 2017. And if I might pause, Madam Chair, to reemphasize, these kits were identified in local law enforcement agencies, not the State Crime Lab. The State Crime Lab was directed to compile and report its findings to this body by March 1st, 2018. And many of you were present at the State Crime Lab on February 28th as Attorney General Stein and I shared the report with the public. What follows are efforts the State Crime Lab undertook to ensure the report was as complete as possible. The resources needed to address this issue could only be determined if an accurate count could be taken. The State Crime Lab worked closely with the North Carolina Sheriff's Association the North Carolina Association of Chiefs of Police, and other stakeholders. A.G. Stein and I are pleased that representatives from the Sheriff's Association and the North Carolina Association of Chiefs of Police are present today. And Madam Chair, if I might pause and just recognize Sheriff Clemens from Richmond County and Chief Zudema from Garner PD, who are here today. As a result of the inventory the State Crime Lab reported, 15,160 untested kits. You will note that there are five categories listed. The last category, referred to as other, was used to capture kits that did not get counted in the other four categories. The State Crime Lab wanted to ensure we were able to report as accurate numbers as we could. More importantly, because of the cooperation, we were able to report that 92% of the law enforcement agencies reported back to the State Crime Laboratory. Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to ask Legislative Liaison Bradford Sneed to come and present the recommendations of the department.
You will please come forward.
Thank you for being here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, because of your foresight, we now know that there are a little over 15,000 untested sexual assault kits in the state of North Carolina. Because we now know this, it is imperative that we develop a plan and a policy and a procedure for moving forward. As you'll see in our report, we make several recommendations. The first recommendation is to test all kits. However, when you look at the 15,000 kits, those are all individual kits that have their own set of circumstances, complex circumstances, which is why we are recommending a committee of experts, of legislators, stakeholders, victim advocates, defense attorneys, and prosecutors to sit and drill down on this data and come up with a strategic plan on how we move forward in testing these kits. For instance, you'll see a little over 2,700 kits tied to adjudicated cases. So adjudicated cases means that these cases have been resolved in court. So for example, if you have a perpetrator who has pled guilty to a felony sexual offense and a victim then does not proceed with testing their kit, that defendant and a perpetrator's DNA would have been uploaded to the DNA database when they entered the state's correctional facility. And the victim in this case would have already received justice. So using public resources to testing that specific kit might be a lower priority based upon some of the other kits that are in the 15,000. Another example would be kits that are tied to anonymous cases. This is where a victim has wished to remain anonymous and has not wished to move forward with prosecution. The federal law, Violence Against Women's Act, prohibits us from testing these kits, and we also want to respect the victim's wishes in remaining anonymous. So as you can see, again, these are very nuanced issues. Each kit has a complex set of circumstances surrounding it, which is why we need an expert committee to drill down and come up with a plan forward to test these untested kits. The second recommendation that we have is to establish a statewide sexual assault evidence collection kit tracking system. This is very important. Again, I think we need to build off of, we finally now know that there are a little over 15,000 untested sexual assault kits. We don't want to go back to a time where we're unsure how many sexual assault kits exist in the state. This tracking system will do that. It will allow us to know in real time with real data how many sexual assault kits are in the state. It will also allow the victim the ability to track their kit, just like you and I would track a package to ensure it gets to its destination. Track the kit from the medical facility to law enforcement to testing and then back to law enforcement. I think by doing this, it would certainly show that North Carolina is very serious about sexual assault. It will provide a message to the victims that they are entitled to justice and that we're going to be providing the tools and resources that they can achieve justice. I do want to point out again that Chief Zudema, Sheriff Clemens are here in support of these recommendations, and so is NC CASA. So without further ado, I'd like to turn it back over to Director Byrd.
So I think at this
time we'll go ahead and ask Corey Goldsmith to explain the proposed legislation, and then we may have questions for both of you.
Madam Chair, we have a few more slides to share.
Okay, proceed.
Okay. Bradford, I need my notes back.
Thank you.
My apologies, Madam Chair. A package can be tracked via a barcode from the factory to your front door. The technology is available now to track sexual assault evidence collection kits the same way. There are a number of vendors available to track sexual assault kits. Prices range from over $2 million and down. I reached out to Idaho back last fall to examine their program and system. They were very gracious in working with us and agreed to provide their program to the state of North Carolina at no cost. Arkansas is also using this program, and in the next few slides, I'm going to demonstrate the Idaho system for you. The screenshot above depicts what a law enforcement agency would see when they log in and click on into the tracking system. This is their pending submission tab that you see. The agency has six cases that need to be sent to the lab. Five of them are highlighted to show that they have been in the agency's custody for more than 30 days and need to be sent to the lab as soon as possible. The amount of days that can elapse before the kit is highlighted is configurable. There are multiple tabs on the screen, starting from left to right. The incoming tab, the cases they need to, are the cases that need to go, that need to be picked up, from the hospital. The pending submission tab are those cases that need to go to the lab. The at the lab are those cases, obviously, at the lab. Analyzed are those cases that have come back from the lab and are in long-term storage at the law enforcement agency. And then not meeting criteria are those cases that are not going to be submitted for whatever reason. So what you're seeing now is a live shot of the Idaho State Police sexual assault kit tracking system. And so this is just an example of what North Carolina may appear to, or may look like. Again, this is a public website, so the victims would have as access to this as well as law enforcement district attorneys or law enforcement agencies. So this is the screen in which someone would enter the number of the unique kit that they are trying to determine the location and the status of that kit. So I'm going to enter in just a couple of numbers. In this depiction, it is a pictorial depiction that you can see the status of the kit. The kit was created on January 1st at the vendor, in this case, the Forensic Laboratory in Idaho, and then it was received at the local medical facility, and then it was received at the Sheriff's Department, then forwarded to the Crime Laboratory. And if you look in the top right-hand corner, you'll see it was analyzed by the lab. And so now it's been sent back to the Sheriff's Department in February 22nd of 2016. And then coming down below that, you'll see a blue bar with a date in it, September 21st, 2015. That date depicts when this particular kit was collected from the medical facility by a sexual assault victim, or collected by a SANE from a sexual assault victim or reported sexual assault. And the key difference here, this is reported versus unreported. An unreported would not appear in this particular screen. This screen depicts another kit that has also been analyzed, and the blue bar situated in the middle depicts something very important, which is this particular kit developed, or the crime lab developed, a DNA profile from an unknown person. That DNA profile, the second date listed, it was actually uploaded into the CODIS database. And then the last line, the last blue line, depicts the date when there was an actual hit to the DNA database to this unknown profile. Now, this is very important. As we've talked about, victims deserve the right to know what's going on with their kit. They deserve to know if the kit has been has received a hit in CODIS and what the status is of their kit. In this kit, or in this system, the victim is completely anonymous, but is able to enter their kit's unique number to quickly access the information about their kit. So this slide before you, as we moved forward with this particular system, though Idaho provided this system to us for free, there is a cost to be able to customize it for North Carolina. And what you see depicted on the slide, including an administrator, a programmer, and website security and maintenance fee, that's what the cost for the Idaho system in North Carolina would cost for North Carolina, Madam Chair. The State Crime Lab has not been sitting on its laurels, though. We identified this as an issue back in 2016, and as the toxicology outsourcing project began to wind down, we determined that we wanted to be good stewards of the funding that this body presented to the State Crime Lab, or appropriated to the State Crime Lab. And so we leaned forward and created or established contracts with two vendors in 2017 to test untested sexual assault kits. We then reached out to law enforcement agencies and asked them to volunteer to test their kits with us, to send their kits to us so that we could outsource them. To date, we have tested 248 kits. But as you can see, the numbers, the State Crime Lab is focused on testing kits that are current, so kits that are less than 1 year old are what we are focused on, and we have the resources to test those and to stay current. But the 15,000 identified in law enforcement agencies, we frankly do not have the resources to handle those in-house. This past January, I was made aware of a grant that was going to come from the Bureau of Justice Assistance. So in speaking with our Attorney General, I talked to him, and he agreed that we were going to apply for this grant. This grant will, if it were to be awarded to North Carolina, would provide some resources for our tracking system. There will be follow-on things that we have to do with our inventory that will require funding. There are eight goals for this grant. The first four are on the screen. Now, this grant, if it was awarded, would be for $3 million, and it would not be awarded, or if it was awarded, it would be latter part of 2018, with the funding being made available in early 2019. Of that funding, only 50% can be used for actual testing of kits. The other half of that money is to change the statewide climate to embrace a holistic victim-centric investigations through training to prosecutors, law enforcement, and medical providers. And Madam Chair, we have sat down over the last couple of weeks or so with North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault, the North Carolina Association of Chiefs of Police, the North Carolina Sheriff's Association, and the North Carolina Conference of DAs, and asked them to partner with us on this grant, to be in support of this grant. And all have come forward to say they're in support of that grant. That's why they're present here today. In addition, within the Department of Justice, director of the North Carolina Justice Academy, as well as the director of training standards and sheriffs and standards, have come forward to also be a part of this task force to help us figure out how to get this grant in North Carolina to, again, as the state crime lab tries to lean forward to address this issue, as we do not have the resources internally to do it by ourselves. Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation, and I'm open to questions at this time.
Questions from the committee. Representative Turner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The agencies you listed, when you say they're supportive of applying for the grant. Is that what you mean?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then I had some questions on the types of cases you had listed. The on slide 5, the survey results.
Yes, ma'am.
The victim wanted to remain anonymous. It would not be necessary to test those kits. Is that correct? Or is that to be determined?
Ma'am, that would be to be determined by the committee. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then those that were tied to a case but resolved in court would already have the DNA in the database. Is that correct?
Again, Representative Turner, that each case is unique, and so it will really take that committee, the recommended committee, to determine that and be able to make the decisions on how to move forward. The state crime lab is prepared to test whatever we need to test, whether through outsourcing or internal. But that decision, because there are so many, the priority in looking at each individual case, we believe that a committee needs to make that decision.
Thank you. And let's see, the suspect admitted, so we don't know if they were imprisoned, so there would be database or not.
We do not know.
And let's see. And then those that were just other that you said.
Yes, ma'am.
We don't know about those either. So how specific would it, how detailed would it be for the committee to follow up on those?
I think with the committee, it will be more important to establish the protocols, and then working with our stakeholders, we'll figure out how to move it forward.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Turner, do you have any other questions? Representative Stevens.
Thank you, and I believe Representative Turner got to a lot of my questions, but if the allegations were unfounded, would we test those kits?
Again, Representative Stevens, it's not my job to determine which ones. I will test the ones that the protocols that are established will tell me to test.
Thank you, and I saw something in here that basically implied a financial amount to test all of these kits. Now or in the future, we're going to have this group to determine whether these kits, in fact, should even be tested. I mean, whether there's a constitutional issue, whether there's a privacy issue, whether there's already a conviction where they do appear on record. But I'm assuming that's what you're saying they're going to do. I just don't want the legislation to reflect that we plan to test all 15,000 kits, because I don't know how much of it seems necessary. Thank you.
Representative McNeil.
Thank you. My questions go to what we're requiring. And I know that having 32 years in law enforcement, actually having raped and been at hospital and done rape kits, I know what we're facing on this. It's a serious consideration. But we're mandating in this legislation that everybody has to participate. So I guess what I'm asking is this. In those hospital emergency rooms when these kits are being done, and in some of these smaller agencies, what hardware, I assume that you're going to provide them with the software, but what hardware is going to be needed in these hospitals, because if you're doing it by barcoding, I mean, you're going to have to have certain hardware that can actually scan those barcodes and bring this up. So is there any money that we're going to provide in this money that you're allocating for these smaller agencies to buy barcoding equipment, or what's the cost going to be to the hospitals and the other agencies?
Representative McNeil, that's a great question. And one of the reasons why we went to Idaho is because their barcodes have unique numbers that go with the barcode. So you'll see the barcode, and then immediately underneath it, there's a number. So agencies that can't afford to buy a simple scanner can just simply enter the number into any basic computer that has internet access, and they'll be able to access the system.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your report. My question is about the 92% who didn't bother, the other 8% who didn't bother to answer. Can you give us a list of those? I don't know that you want to bring them out, but how many, and that could be thousands more or whatever, maybe.
Representative Hurley, so in the report, in the actual report that was released March the 1st, the appendix at the back has all of the agencies listed for North Carolina. We believe that most of those agencies are small private police, private protective police, small company police. There were only 46 agencies that did not respond out of the over 550 agencies that we had in our initial list.
Thank you. One comment. I noticed that in anything that we ask for, lots of times they just ignore. Many people do, so I'm just amazed. Thank you. We do need answers.
Thank you, ma'am.
So the questions from the committee? Seeing none, I will call on Corey Goldsmith to go over the actual piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Corey Goldsmith with the Bill Drafting Division. Members of the committee, this is the Bill Draft 2017 MM129V5, and it is based on the recommendations made by the Crime Lab. So it establishes a statewide sexual assault evidence collection kit tracking system. And by October 1, 2018, all kits purchased or distributed after that date shall be trackable and comply with the requirements of the system. Directs the director to implement protocols, and then to ensure that the system protects victim information against disclosure to non-participating agencies, and the information that is in the system is confidential and not considered a public record. It does require participation of all medical providers, law enforcement agencies, forensic laboratories, and other persons or entities having custody or use of any sexual assault evidence kit in the state. Those participating entities are permitted and are required to be permitted to have access to the tracking system. It also states that the policy of the state is for sexual assault victims or victims of attempted sexual assault to also be able to track the location and condition of the evidence kit that was collected during the forensic testing or during when the collected from the victim. And then it also goes on to direct the require the director to implement protocols to ensure that previously untested sexual assault collection kits are trackable and entered into the system. And for purposes of this section, a previously untested sexual assault evidence collection kit means a kit that has not undergone forensic testing and was identified and included in the report that you heard earlier in the meeting. To the extent practicable, they would also the participating law enforcement agency would take reasonable measures to provide appropriate tracking information to the affected victim. And there is an annual report to the General Assembly, to this committee, beginning October 1, 2019, for the prior fiscal year regarding, you can read the different types of information and data that would be reported to the committee. Section 2 directs the secretary in consultation with the director to require that all sexual assault evidence collection kits purchased or distributed on or after October 1, 2018 are compatible with the system that's required in the earlier created statute. Section 3 creates the a working group to make recommendations regarding the testing priority of the untested kits. The way this is, this would be convened by the Secretary of the Department of Public Safety. It does not specifically direct that legislators be part of the working group, but there's nothing to prohibit them from being included. It does have a list of those who must be included, and there would be a report back to the General Assembly, to this committee, December 1, 2018.
So, questions regarding the proposed legislation? Seeing none, thank you. We will move to the final item, other than our actual report, will be the enhanced prison security, and Corey Goldsmith again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, this bill draft is 2017-MSZ-159V5. Section 1 broadens the definition of what constitutes malicious conduct by a prisoner to include exposure of genitalia or somebody who masturbates, and also causes to be used throwing or emitting or throwing or sending in somebody's direction an unknown substance, and then sentences imposed under the article would run consecutively and commence at the expiration of any sentence being served by the person who committed the crime, who was convicted of the commission of the crime. Section 2 changes the administrative remedy procedure so that, and this is over on page 2, if the prisoner fails to timely file a grievance or to file a grievance at all within the time frame after 90 days, then they would be barred from any further action, and it does remove language that previously allowed a court to waive the exhaustion requirement in the interest if the court found it was necessary in the interest of justice. It also provides that for a claim of damages for under $500, that the administrative procedure remedy procedure is the prisoner's sole remedy. And Section 3 adds simply that the Secretary may establish a designee. Then Section 4 is the effective date for the crime, or the additional conditions for the crime that are in Section 1. That's effective December 1, 2018, applying to offenses committed on or after that date. Section 2, because it's an administrative procedure, would be effective October 1, 2018, and apply to grievances filed on or after that date. The rest of the Act is effective when it becomes law.
So, questions on the proposed legislation or the recommendation from the committee?
As far as the bills?
As far as this one bill, the prison enhancement bill. If you remember when the department talked about this early on when they reported to the committee, this was one of the requests that they felt would enhance safety and security at the prisons and show some respect to the officers in the units. Yes, Representative Bowles.
In with this bill, we have not, with the NIC report, have not made any administrative, and we are waiting on the department to get back with us, correct?
Mm-hmm. So we'll go into the excuse me, Representative McNeil.
I just have a question. This is probably from staff for staff. You know, one of the problems that we heard today from a lot of the people that spoke is the fact that when a guard's assaulted, it goes to the district attorney's office and nothing ever gets done about it. You know, they either just dismiss the cases because the person's already in prison, or they give them a slap on the hand and give them 30 days. I think this is a good bill. I think it's necessary, but I'm just wondering if we're not throwing just another crime out there that district attorneys are not going to take seriously. So my question to staff is this, and I know you're getting over into the judicial branch here, and I understand that, Is there anything that we can do in this to beef it up to make sure that district attorneys have to do something with it? And I think I know the answer to that, but there it is.
Ms. Goldsmith. If I may, I would like to defer to Susan Sykes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you referred to, Representative O'Neill, I think you know the answer. The General Assembly has generally allowed DA discretion in prosecuting crimes, and that is a policy decision. It is certainly within the purview of the General Assembly to add language to a statute requiring DAs to do certain things in relation to certain acts. That is a policy decision for the General Assembly to make that they have typically not made because of, in part, district attorneys are elected officials as well. But as to what that should be to make them be prosecuted more, I don't really have any suggestion for that, but it is certainly within the purview of the General Assembly to amend the statutes to require the DAs to take certain actions.
Follow up.
Madam Chair, I hope that's something that we could explore as we go through this process, because it doesn't do any good to just keep adding new laws and the cases continuing to get dismissed. And I know as part of this committee and other JPS committees, I've toured the prisons and I've talked to superintendents, and it's really high up on the list, the fact that whenever, especially here in Wake County, especially when a guard gets assaulted, nothing, that's basically it, to get charged, and that's the end of it. So,
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for staff. What provisions might exist that can be used administratively by the prison system when someone violates an action like this that we're talking about in this bill, rather than sending it to court and adding another 30 days or 60 days or 6 months to a sentence, which is just simply costing us more money to keep somebody in prison? Is there anything administratively that can be done by the prison system to punish a person for doing this act?
Department could probably speak in more detail, but in general, there are things they can do, such as segregation. They can modify their class. For example, if they're in a minimum security facility, their levels could be bumped back up so that they're placed back into a medium security facility. So there are things like that that they can take within their current system as consequences for behavior. And they have guidelines for what those steps are in response to what actions, but they cannot extend periods of confinement because those are statutory and constitutional. You can't extend the sentence. Now, it could be they may not earn time off their maximum sentence to be released on post-release supervision as fast, so the time they spend in the prison could be extended in that manner, but their overall sentence cannot be extended.
Follow up. I guess I'm looking for something that would do the job needs to be done to deter people from doing this kind of action, but could be done administratively and not result in longer sentences, which cost us more. I mean, it costs enough now in prison. The longer we keep people, it's just an additional cost. If we could deter this behavior by some type of administrative action, it seems like it would be better for all, because it's hard for a person to relate to, if he's got 10 more years to go and they add 6 months to that, it's hard for him to even relate to that 6 months. But if he's due to get a Hershey bar tonight for a treat and it gets taken away from him, he can realize that right away. And I use that facetiously.
Representative Rogers.
One suggestion for staff or any of the representatives or myself, if I can remember,
One thing that works in court is being in court every day is the DWIs, as far as dismissals go, with DWIs, the DA can't dismiss them unless he does a long form, we call it, and that he explains why he's dismissing it. And so DAs are very reluctant to dismiss DWIs for that reason, because they have to explain completely why they did it. That would be one possibility to make sure they're not just dismissed. And the other possibility would be to treat them like we treat contempt. Contempt's always going to run, pretty much always going to run consecutive. We could put something like that in the bill, that it won't be dismissed unless the DA gets a very good explanation for it. And if he's convicted of it, it's time that we'll run consecutive to the current sentence.
So, Representative McNeil, would you like to propose an amendment?
I certainly would. Whether it be that there has to be some kind of hearing before a judge, or whether he has to fill out a long form, whatever seems to be the best way that we as the legislature can fix that. And I'd like to make it not only for this statute, but I'd like to make it for the other assaults that prison guards.
Yeah, and that may get outside of the proposal that's before us, because this one actually came through JPS oversight, but it's something that we could consider legislation-wise.
That's fine. If
we can
for the purposes of this, we could just reduce this to just this issue right here, mm-hmm. and look at the other issues later on.
Mr. Chairman, clarification.
Representative Bowles.
With staff, Susan, aren't correctional officers already dealt the same as other law enforcement officers?
As far as the penalty statutes for assault upon them, yes, they are the same offense. They're in the same statutes, although in most of the statutes they're listed separately, but they're treated the same.
And Representative McNeil, I guess what I hope you would include all of that. I mean, with a not just correctional officers, but any law enforcement officers that could not be dismissed without the long form.
Susan Seitz.
Madam Chair, if I can, since we are looking at a bill draft, and I'm not clear exactly what Representative McNeil has decided he wants to recommend, it's kind of difficult for us to then go and amend this draft later after the committee's voted on it. Do we have a couple of options? We can leave this particular issue out of it at the moment, and then once it's introduced, in the meantime, we can work on drafting what Representative McNeil would like so that it would be ready once the bill is introduced. Or we can suspend adoption of this bill for us to have some time to determine what that is.
So basically you're saying leave this particular legislation, this proposed legislation, out of the report, and then proceed with a separate bill that would be filed.
If I may, Madam Chair, I don't believe a separate bill would be eligible without the recommendation of this committee. So if the committee feels like they want to recommend what is currently in the bill, it would probably be wise to go ahead and adopt that. And then if Representative McNeil is okay, we will work on a modification to that bill to be added once the bill's been introduced this session. I don't believe we can draft it right now before the committee recommends this bill. If that is your desire, we'd have to wait to another meeting to do that.
I'm fine with that. Can I have a question then? Could we make it part of the committee report that we recommend? And not part of the bill. I understand you're talking about just leaving the bill as it is, but could we make it part of the committee report that the committee recommends that type of language be looked at for later addition or amendment or whatever?
It is my understanding that the committee, there is not going to be a formal consolidated report that shows minutes and all that the recommendations we make of these bills today will be recommended. The committee can certainly adopt a recommendation to that effect, which would go in our minutes, which would make it a recommendation of the committee, but my understanding is we're not going to have a separate full-blown report absent these three drafts that the committee may choose to adopt.
Yes, Representative Bowles.
Ms. Goldsmith.
Yes, sir.
If we adopt this and it goes before committee, at that point in time, Representative McNeil can add an amendment.
Yes, sir. Once the bill is, if the bill comes as a recommendation of the generals of this study committee, then it's eligible for consideration during the short session. As the bill then, once it's introduced, moves through the committee process, any member could amend it, offer an amendment or a committee substitute to expand its scope, address additional issues.
Thank you. And that's fine with me, understanding that it might not land in the committee that I'm a part of, so therefore I couldn't amend it, as long as somebody does.
Someone will do that for you, Representative McNeil.
You have friends.
I love y'all.
So, other questions or discussion regarding this proposed legislation? So, seeing none, if you'll give me 1 second, Representative Davis. So, today we talked about the advisory board for North Carolina prison reform. And I would like to make a recommendation that should be included in our report, that we're going to recommend to the JPS appropriation chairs that they include in the budget a requirement that the North Carolina Prison Reform Advisory Board report their findings, conclusions, recommendations on a quarterly basis to JPS oversight.
Uh-oh, she don't like it.
Can we?
Controversy. Turn this off.
So we're going to have the minutes include the recommendation from this committee to have the JPS appropriation chairs include a provision in the budget to address the reporting requirement for North Carolina Prison Reform Advisory Board. Does that cover it? Thank you. So I will now recognize Representative Davis for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would move that the committee recommend Bill Draft 2017-TQ-36 as amended, 2017-MSX-159, and 2017-MM-129 to the 2018 legislative short session of the General Assembly.
So do we have a discussion on the motion, which is to include the three budgets that we have, the three legislative proposals that we have just discussed as our recommendation to the General Assembly? Seeing none, do I hear a second? Representative Turner, do we have any follow-up discussion? Seeing none, the motion is adopted, and we will not meet again, so we'll see you after the short session, and we will proceed with oversight unless something comes up during the session that we need to address. But we will do our best to start getting quarterly reports so we will know what's going on with the prison reform. So thank you all for coming, and I look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you.